This is Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I began this podcast back in 2011, I couldn't imagine I'd still be producing it 12 years later. When I began, I sought to add content in context to conversations that often lacked certain perspectives. Today, I am proud to say I have not only done that, but I continue to do that. During my time on the air, many better podcasts have come and gone. And they have come and gone because they didn't have the support that they needed to survive. Today, we need great podcasts, great news sources, but most importantly, we need greater information. So, using your hard-earned dollars, support the projects that give you that information. Oftentimes, those projects are local or regional. They're not that big, and they never will be. Support the things that add true value to your life. I am your host, Vymir Disogaya. I hope you enjoy the show.
And now, the definition. Definition.
But the thing about the both sides do it lie is the inciting incident for that specific lie is almost always an explicitly Republican atrocity. Republicans may be openly embracing fascism, for example, but what about speech codes on a few elite universities, huh? What about that, huh? And Donald Trump may be an openly corrupt racist scumbag, but what about Hillary Clinton's emails, huh? What about that, huh? However, there are other deeply biased assumptions built into the institutional media that are also so common that you might never notice them until someone points them out. But these other biases usually reveal themselves when the inciting incident comes not from the right, but from the left. But first, you're all very smart and you all know everything, so you all are familiar with Merck's Law, right? M-U-R-C-X
Law. I had to be reminded of what this means, so.
Yeah.
Tell us what Merck's Law is, Driftglass.
Everybody pull up a chair and Uncle Driftglass is going to tell you what Merck's Law is. Merck's Law is the widespread assumption that only Democrats have any agency or influence over American politics. Republican behavior, no matter how reprehensible, is considered to be just a force of nature, like a hurricane or a forest fire. You can't expect Republicans not to wreck cities or burn things down. That's just their nature. That's who they are. Instead, it's the responsibility of Democrats to shut up and rebuild what Republicans have destroyed and put out whatever fires Republicans have started. That's how things work in our world. And if what Republicans have destroyed can't be rebuilt, or fires they've started can't be put out, well, Democrats are obviously the ones to blame.
We had a perfect example of that recently in the past year with David Gregory.
Oh, yeah.
And, House Republicans taking 14 votes to put Kevin McCarthy in power and then voting him out. And then who is going to figure out who's the next speaker? And what does David Gregory say? Well, what are the Democrats going to do about it?
The Democrats have to take some responsibility.
Yeah, I'm really looking at the Democrats to see what they're going to do about this.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the media's perennial freakout over civility. The most recent panic over civility came last week during James Comer's never-ending House Oversight Committee hearing. The hearings that collapsed into a humiliating farce last year, but are still hobbling along, promising that evidence of impeachable offenses against somebody, anybody, is just around the corner. That hearing. And at that hearing last week, Marjorie Taylor Greene was, as usual, a racist troll. And that's me being nice.
Yeah.
I've used worse words than that, Driftglass.
You have. I've heard you. I've been shocked, but I've heard you. Mm-hmm.
And you told me to stick with racist, which was good.
Yeah.
That Pick one, blue gal.
Mm-hmm.
To the racist troll get up, Marjorie Taylor Greene, it is rumored, added a few pops of bourbon.
You know.
And, you know what kind of a drunk she is.
Yeah. A happy-go-lucky, cheerful drunk.
No. Sure. A mean drunk. Because she's a mean person. But none of that is news.
Right.
Just another Republican tornado or house fire. What made it news was Representative Jasmine Crockett returning fire. And Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez having her back.
Yep.
Now it's news. Because now it's Democrats doing it. Now it's Democrats pushing back.
Right.
With bleach blonde bad body. Whatever. Butch, whatever. It's all there. And suddenly, attention has been called to the strangeness of the situation, the bizarre asymmetry of it all.
You feel that? You've actually been trained for this, Mr. Fisher. Pay attention to the strangeness of the weather, the shift in gravity. None of this is real. You're in a dream.
And then, and only then, do the tone police arrive to admonish who? Both sides.
Both sides, Bluegill. Both sides.
This is Speaker Mike Johnson, who, you know, because Jasmine Crockett made this an issue and pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Johnson had to say, when we disagree, even vehemently, we have got to treat one another with dignity and respect.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an important principle.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Slate, quote, House Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Jasmine Crockett's fight is Congress's latest teenage drama. Fake eyelashes taunts, a secret love affair, a pointless field trip. It's a real high school soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
No, it isn't.
No, it's not.
It's not.
And that was really the tone of the news from the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Even over at the Bulwark, our old friend Tom Nichols, who blocks me, you know, for talking about the past, his reaction was pretty typical. Quote, Green's point is to convince people who aren't really paying attention to politics that, look, we all suck. We're all terrible. And none of us are better than the others. And I can prove it. And I think that, you know, I know it sucks to always have to be the grown-ups. It sucks to always have to be, you know, the people that are speaking in measured tones. And I know everybody wants to punch a bully. But I think that, you know, Green is a troll. She's trying to draw the foul. She's trying to turn the meeting into chaos, unquote. That was Tom Nichols on the Bulwark like yesterday. Except Tom, and I know you listen to this podcast, Tom, because this is where you get most of your ideas from, Tom. The entire Republican Party is now nothing but trolls. Your Republican Party is nothing but trolls. And that bullshit hearing is already chaos, and it has been chaos for a year. Tom really does seem to forget that we here on the left, over his strong objections, we actually elected the speaking in measured tones voice guy as president. We elected him twice. And what was the reaction from Tom's party? It was an 8-year racist primal scream, which all sober, sensible people who led Tom's Republican Party were totally cool with because it got them the results they wanted. Then Tom's party nominated and elected the king of the birthers, the czar of all trolls, and they're running him again. Now, there's a story I think I've told on this podcast before about an entomologist, and that's a bug guy, a person who specializes in insects. He's in Chicago walking with a friend down a very busy street at rush hour. And if you've ever been to a big city, especially Chicago at rush hour, you know what that sounds like. Suddenly, this guy claims he can hear the chirping of a particularly rare cricket. And his friend says, bullshit, you can't hear that. No one can hear anything over the sound of traffic and the people talking and the horns and the L. It's impossible. So the entomologist takes a few coins out of his pocket and tosses them in the air. And when they hit the ground, everybody turns to look. And the entomologist turns to his friend and says, see, what you hear all depends on what you are listening for.
For decades, people like Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin,
mm-hmm.
Michael Savage, Jerry Falwell were all just background noise to the elite right. Normal traffic noise that they had long since begun automatically filtering out and ignoring. David Brooks saying, I don't know what Rush Limbaugh says. I don't know.
I don't know. Who knows?
But Dems punching back, that's the coins hitting the pavement. That attracts their attention. And then, just like that, they start demanding civility.
Mm-hmm.
Because Merck's law.
Yeah.
But what is a pundit supposed to do when the issue isn't who's behaving badly, but who's right? What's a pundit supposed to do when it starts to become clear that the left is very publicly and manifestly correct about current events?
Uh-oh.
Well, now, whipping out the both sides do it lie and conjuring imaginary sins on the left to balance out actual atrocities on the right won't cover it. And getting your panties in a bunch about civility only when the left pushes back won't cover it.
Right. Right.
Instead, in case the danger is the left being proven right, the pundit must conjure an imaginary state of equally plausible rightness on the right. The left was right about some things, but the right was right also.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, maybe.
Or more specifically, a state of potential rightness on the right. David Brooks is the classic example of this. And DriftGlass has, you know, hundreds of posts of mm-hmm. David Brooks doing just this. For 20 years, he's been pitching the fairy tale that, sure, conservatism in the Republican Party might look bad now, but in the very near future, they're going to be awesome.
Yep.
And to date, he has never been right once.
Never. Never been right. Still has a job. Same
so
job.
So we're going to call that the let me sleep on it lie.
Let me sleep on it. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it. I'll give you an answer in the morning.
Well, it was quite interesting because, like, the first day, Keenan on my team, he put together one with AI real quick. Y'all had that one ready? Okay, he did a remix. Okay, play his remix.
Peach blowing, bad built, butch body, shut your trap. Jealous of my style, cause you know I got that snap. Talking loud, online, you ain't built for that scrap. Keep your distance, I ain't dealing with your cap. You think you slick, tryna flex with your fake gold. All that boxed up, surgery, you look old. Bleach blonde, she died, roots showing real bold. Ain't got no shape but acting tough, man, you cold. Whispers in the crew, you know you can't relate. Bad built, botched up, jealousy's your trait. Can't fake the
right, phone, so, he put that one together. Did you hear the gospel one?
Yes, I love it. It's so amazing.
Y'all roll that one, roll that one.
She got a bleach blonde, bad girl, butch body.
She got a bleach blonde, bad girl, butch body.
Then Marjorie Taylor Greene looked like a lima bean.
I forgot she had a bleach blonde, bad girl, butch body.
Representative Jasmine's about that light.
She about that, and she looks like she can really fight.
An amazing politician, ain't got no competition.
Ain't worried about a bleach blonde, bad build butch body.
Marjorie tried to cause a scene, forgot she had a butch body.
Marjorie tried to cause a scene, forgot she had a butch body.
Marjorie tried to cause a scene, forgot she had a butch body.
Marjorie tried to cause a scene, forgot she had a butch body.
Lashes, black women with lashes, they won't give you lashes. Black women with lashes, they won't give you lashes.
Don't come for us unless we sit for you.
She got a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. She got a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. A bleach blonde, bad built butch body. She got a bleach blonde, bad built butch body.
Say it again.
Isaac Hayes' son did one.
Oh, I know. It was called the Clapbacks. Roll
yes,
it.
Yes. He did one.
Roll the Clapbacks.
She's a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. She's a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. She's a bleach blonde, bad built butch body. And she better not talk about nobody. Is built like a shake machine. Nick Nolte in the face. Cereal box in the waist. She better learn her place, cause she's about to catch a case. Talk about a black woman's lash, she'll definitely whoop your ass. She better get her face right, cause she looks like a pack of bud
light. Oh yeah. Bush body. She's a beach blonde, bad
probably the one. So that's that old school sound. The Brother King Wilonius, I gotta admit.
That one is so, that's so good.
Yo, I was flying to Palm Springs for Anthony Anderson's 6th Annual Celebrity Golf Classic on Saturday. Let me just say, I probably had that playing at least an hour on the plane. Roll it. I don't have that. How y'all don't have that? That was one of the first ones.
I know.
What is wrong with y'all? Congresswoman, I told the staff, pull all of them. I told them, pull all of them. But all this whining y'all in my ear right now don't mean nothing. But yeah, but guess what? I'm always prepared. Always prepared. So yeah, roll it. Just pull the audio up. How y'all ain't having ready?
No, this is a good one. Where Comer is like a wood now.
Y'all got any one of those in there?
Oh my goodness.
All right, let me hear that one. I need to hear that one. First of all, let's see that one too. Go ahead, go.
Bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bush body.
A what now? A what now?
Swing! The wing makes God!
Bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bush body.
A what now?
Bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bleach blonde, bad built, bush body. I'm just curious. Bad built, bad built, bad built, bad built, bad built, bad built, bush body.
A what now?
Bad built, bad built, bad built, bad built.
Oh my God!
Bad built, bush body.
Yo, the creativity. The creativity of people is amazing. That this thing has taken off quickly.
Yes. Yeah. I'm appreciative. It's great. I you know what? For the first time in a long time, a lot of people that haven't been engaged in politics, they're engaging. So again, what she meant for bad, God meant for good.
If there is one thing I would like to claim as my own, it is the comparative theory of superpower collapse. For now, it remains just a theory, although it is currently being quite thoroughly tested. The theory states that the United States and the Soviet Union will have collapsed for roughly the same reasons, namely, a severe and chronic shortfall in the production of crude oil, that magic addictive elixir of industrial economies, a severe and worsening trade deficit, a runaway military budget, and ballooning foreign debt. I call this particular list of ingredients the superpower collapse soup. Other factors, such as the inability to provide an acceptable quality of life for its citizens or a systemically corrupt political system incapable of reform, are certainly not helpful, but they do not automatically lead to collapse because they do not put the country on a collision course with reality. Please don't be concerned, though, because, as I mentioned, this is just a theory, my theory. I've been working on this theory since about 1995, when it occurred to me that the US is retracing the same trajectory as the USSR. As so often is the case, having this realization was largely a matter of being in the right place at the right time. The two most important methods of solving problems are, one, by knowing the solution ahead of time, and two, guessing it correctly. I learned this in engineering school from a certain professor. I'm not that good at guesswork, but I do sometimes know the answer ahead of time. I was very well positioned to have this realization because I grew up straddling the two worlds, the USSR and the US. I grew up in Russia and moved to the US when I was 12, and so I'm fluent in Russian and I understand Russian history and Russian culture the way only a Russian native can. But I also went through high school and university in the US. I had careers in several industries here. I traveled widely around the country, and so I also have a very good understanding of the US with all its quirks and idiosyncrasies. I traveled back to Russia in 1989 when things still seemed pretty much in line with the Soviet norm, and again in 1990 when the economy was at a standstill and big changes were clearly on the way. I went back there three more times in the 1990s and observed the various stages of Soviet collapse firsthand. By mid-1990s, I started to see the Soviet-American superpowerdom as a sort of disease that strives for world dominance, but in effect eviscerates its host country, eventually leaving behind an empty shell, an impoverished population, an economy in ruins, a legacy of social problems, and a tremendous burden of debt. The symmetries between the two global superpowers were then already too numerous to mention, and they have been growing more obvious ever since. The superpower symmetries may be of interest to policy wonks and history buffs and various skeptics, but they tell us nothing that would be useful in our daily lives. It is the asymmetries, the differences between the two superpowers, that I believe to be the most instructive.
Good morning, I'm Joan Scott. You know, all across America, men and women are creating and building better futures for their families, their friends, their neighbors. Together, Americans are once again bringing to bear human freedom to create an even greater chance for human happiness. You know, we decided in our Constitution that we the people have real power. Today, we see all over the world people pursuing that very same freedom. Now, during the next hour, you're going to have a chance to join with others across America in celebrating the success stories that are the essence of that American dream. With me this morning is our host, Congressman Newt Gingrich, and joining us live via satellite from Sea Island, Georgia, is former Attorney General Griffin Bell. Good morning, Newt. Good morning, Griffin.
Good morning, Joan. Morning. And Griffin, I particularly want to thank you for being with us. I understand you've recently had some surgery, and we're very glad you'd come with us live. We know it's been a little bit of a difficulty for you.
Well, Newt, you brought us all here together, and why don't you tell us why we're here?
Well, I think we have to go back, frankly, to this document. This is a copy of the Declaration of Independence. You know, when our founding fathers got together and decided that freedom mattered, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, because they thought human freedom was that important. And I want to welcome everyone, everyone here at Sprayberry's, everyone at over 600 workshops around the country, and everyone watching us on Channel 20 in Washington, on the Family Channel all throughout America, because we hope today that we're going to be able to establish the beginnings of a citizens' opportunity movement across the country, really building on successes you're going to see and other successes that we couldn't get into 1 hour that are occurring everywhere in America right now. All of us know that the bureaucratic welfare state has failed. We see it everywhere in East St. Louis, in Detroit, in downtown Washington, D.C. We see it in the Pentagon. We see that big bureaucracies just aren't getting the job done. And we know that the 25-year experiment in permissive attitudes has been a disaster, whether it's the disaster of the AIDS epidemic, the disaster of cocaine and crack and drug addiction, the disaster of violent crime, or the disaster of our young children not learning enough to read in all too many schools. So most Americans say, all right, The bureaucratic welfare state doesn't cut it. Permissive attitudes haven't worked. But then for all too many of us, that becomes a reason to do nothing because they don't see the positive side. And the purpose of this workshop, the workshop gathered right here in Sprayberry's, the workshops across America, and this program reaching out to every American, is to allow us to realize that there are success stories, that there's a key to an America that does work. And you know, we're meeting in an America that works. Sprayberry's was founded in 1926. It's a family-owned business, just honest hard work put right into the traditional free enterprise system. Sprayberry's was founded when there was a dirt road out front. They didn't even have electricity. They had to buy a generator to make their own electricity here. And today, not quite 70 years later, it is a remarkable nationally known institution that draws people from all over the country. And it's in that tradition of success, of can do, of getting the job done, that we wanted to get together. Because we became convinced that America would be saved not in Washington, D.C., not by President George Bush or by any political figure. America would be saved by Americans, by creating a citizens' movement that reached out across the country, and a citizens' movement that understood that there are principles that have worked for over 200 years. What we would call the triangle of American success, literally a little triangle that encompasses the essence of the American tradition. The baseline of that triangle is basic American values: honest hard work, saving, learning, planning for the future, the kind of things we all came to expect to be the essence of an American. Then second side of that triangle is entrepreneurial free enterprise, creating businesses, creating drive, the sense that I can go do something. And the third side is technological progress and free enterprise. We could combine those three into a triangle, and we could suggest to people that inside that triangle, there is an opportunity to apply common sense focused on opportunities and success. That if you apply common sense focused on opportunities and success within those principles, you're almost certainly going to do better than the bureaucratic welfare state and permissive attitudes. And that allows us to say to people, let's liberate folks, let's liberate county governments and city governments and local citizens and communities. Let's create an opportunity for people to go out on their own, not to try to solve the problem of education with one big decision in Washington, not to try to solve the problem of healthcare with one big conference at the White House, but to recognize that it will take thousands of experiments in education and thousands of experiments in healthcare. And that similarly, by decentralizing and giving back power to the American people, that all of us have an opportunity to create the kind of America we want to live in. So that's why we talk about a citizens' opportunities movement. And let me talk briefly about one example, one side of that triangle: technological progress and innovation. You know, it's perfectly appropriate that we start with that particular concept because technological progress and innovation is what lets us have this workshop. It gives us the cameras that are filming us, the satellite broadcast capability to be live across the country, the sheer computer technology to bring together six different sites simultaneously in what has been described as one of the largest private TV networks ever put together. This kind of technological breakthrough, whether it's the microwave oven or the contact lenses that I wear, is the kind of thing that has made America just different from most places on the planet. And we have a chance, I think, today to really talk about new approaches and new technologies. And Joan, that's why I'm so glad to be here with you.
Here is Connie Chung.
Good evening. The Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich of Georgia, is about to make an unprecedented address to the nation, marking the fulfillment of the so-called contract with America. It's the first time a Speaker of the House has asked for television time since television was invented, a sign of the dramatic shift in political power that began when the Republicans won back the Congress 5 months ago tomorrow. Now here is Speaker Newt Gingrich.
Good evening. I want to thank you for joining me tonight and for this chance to give you, the American people, a report on the new Congress, what we've been doing, what we hope to do, and how we're working to keep faith with what you sent us here to do. But first, let me thank the hundreds of thousands of Americans who've written me over the past few months. Your letters, nearly 400,000, are full of good ideas and often moving words of encouragement. This letter, addressed to Dear Mr. Newt, included a portrait of George Washington. It was sent to me by first grader Stephen Frankoviak from Georgia. And I thank Stephen and everyone else who wrote me, even if you didn't include a picture of George Washington. Last September, the House Republicans signed a contract with America. We signed this contract and made some promises to you and to ourselves. You elected us, and for the last 93 days, we have been keeping our word. With your help, we're bringing about real change. We made Congress subject to the same laws as everyone else. We cut congressional committee staffs and budgets by 30%, and we voted on every item in the contract. And I can tell you tonight, we're going to sell one congressional building and privatize at least one congressional parking lot. While we've done a lot, this contract has never been about curing all the ills of the nation. 100 days can't overturn the neglect of decades. The contract's purpose has been to show that change is possible. That even in Washington, you can do what you say you're going to do. In short, we wanted to prove to you, and I think to us, that democracy still has the vitality and the will to do something about the problems facing our nation. And it seems to me that whether you're a conservative or a liberal, that is a very positive thing. And so I want to talk about the contract tonight, our successes and our failures. But I also want to talk about something much larger. Because although I've spent the last 6 months of my life living and breathing and fighting for what's written in this contract, I know the American people want more than these 10 items. So what I want to talk with you about tonight is not just what a new political majority in Capitol Hill has accomplished in 100 days, but how all of us together, Republicans and Democrats alike, must totally remake the federal government to change the very way it thinks, the way it does business, the way it treats its citizens. After all, the purpose of changing government is to improve the lives of our citizens, to strengthen the future of our children, to make our neighborhoods safe, and to build a better country. Government is not the end. It is the means. We Americans wake up every morning, go to work, take our kids to school, fix dinner, do all the things we expect of ourselves, and yet something isn't quite right. There's no confidence that government understands the values and realities of our lives. The government is out of touch and out of control. It is in need of deep and deliberate change. Now, when that change is accomplished, then perhaps Americans will be able to sleep a little better at night and wake up feeling less anxious about their futures. I represented the people who worked at the Ford plant in Hapeville, Georgia. The Ford Motor Company, like all the domestic auto industry, faced the need to change in order to keep up with tougher competition. Today, they produce twice as many cars per employee at three times the quality. And General Motors and Chrysler are doing the very same thing. So are America's small businesses. They're all rethinking the way they operate. Should government be any different? Of course not. We sincerely believe we can reduce spending and at the same time make government better. You know, virtually every institution in America except government has re-engineered itself to become more efficient over the last decade. They cut spending, provided better products, better education, and better service for less. But I believe we must remake government for reasons much larger than saving money or improving services. The fact is, no civilization can survive with 12-year-olds having babies, with 15-year-olds killing each other, with 17-year-olds dying of AIDS, with 18-year-olds getting diplomas they can't even read. Every night, on every local news, we see the human tragedies that have grown out of the current welfare state. And as a father of two daughters, I can't ignore the terror and worry parents in our inner cities must feel for their children. Within a half mile of this capital, your capital, drugs, violence, and despair threaten the lives of our citizens. We cannot ignore our fellow Americans in such desperate straits by thinking that huge amounts of tax dollars release us from our moral responsibility to help these parents and their children. There is no reason the federal government must keep an allegiance to failure. You know, with goodwill, with common sense, with the courage to change, we can do better for all Americans.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your brother, Mary D. So, Gaia. And welcome to this Class War Veteran Podcast special episode. I'm probably gonna... So, the title of today's episode is, Marjorie Taylor Greene as the Canary in the Congress Mine. The success of the Powell Memo is complete. I'm probably gonna release this with the minimum of audio clips, because I think it's actually vital that this get out. The title does give away the key point for the episode, but I really believe that we, as a people in this country, we really do not understand how significant the Powell Memo has been in not only crafting the current political atmosphere, but how it has really resulted in the exact thing that it promoted as being real from the get-go. The idea of small government in the minds of neoconservatives, in the mind of a lot of these so-called never-Trumpers now, the idea of small government was tethered to one reality, to one question, really. Can government operate within a society much more efficiently than a conglomerized oligarchic corporatocracy? Fascism, essentially. Can a government with multiple points of administration within a society do better in managing the health of that society than a oligarchic class with multiple points of incorporation into that same society? Neoconservatives proposed that government could not. Their proposition was based on the idea that government was dysfunctional, and that government had always been dysfunctional, but people had not realized it. Over the past 40 years, neoconservatism has sought to place people in government who would, quote unquote, get government to work more for the people than for the special interests. These people have progressively become more incapable of doing the jobs in which they were sent to Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, but increasingly this is happening at the Senate level too, the jobs that they were sent there to do. Not the job as described by neoconservatives, but the real job of forming legislation, the real job of taking the temperature of the mood within their communities, which they supposedly represent, not the corporate interests, But taking the temperature of the mood within the communities in order to know exactly what those communities need to be prosperous over the long haul. Instead, what neoconservatives have done and what they have promoted was sending people who are ideologically driven to be more attracted to wealth and people with a lot of money than to the needs of their communities. In fact, neoconservatism has bragged in its literature of, from an ideological standpoint, convincing those people who are sent as frontline soldiers to Congress, into the Senate, it is bragged about having them mesh together the items that would benefit the wealthy with items that would benefit the non-wealthy, knowing darn well that just because it benefits the wealthy does not mean that it's going to benefit the non-wealthy. The result has been a Congress, and this obviously is true with a lot of new Democrats too, and Blue Dogs, which I often forget to mention them, but they're still there. This has resulted in a Congress that works more instructively and more concisely for the wealthy and less for you and I. This has also led to an increasing number of conservative congressional people who are just insane. They are not capable of doing the job which they were sent there for, except to be chaos agents, which increasingly that is what the people seem to want. In short, these people are breaking government to prove that government doesn't work. They are breaking government in order to prove the thesis of neoconservatism correct, that government is dysfunctional. Well, if you make government dysfunctional, it will be dysfunctional. Now, to act like this is something new under the recent Congress is insane. I love to give a shout out to the professional left because they're doing the work to document this, to remind us of what we have not remembered. Their podcast, No Fair Remembering Stuff, required listening. But this is not new. During the Bush administration, they had a strategy which is seldom attended to or even discussed anymore. They had a strategy to hollow out various offices that were seen as problematic to Wall Street and the wealthy men and women who they, and they didn't hide this fact, but who they worked for. They let everybody know, this is who we work for. Now, to be fair, there were some points where even George Bush was like, wait a minute, are we going a little bit too far here? But his vice president was okay with going too far. They were hollowing out offices based on contracts that they could give to wealthy people. We have seen this increase, we saw this, increase with Trump. And I'm not 100% sure, but we probably haven't seen it rolled back that much during with Biden in office, but maybe. The key point to understand here, though, is the Powell memo specifically was structured to not only make sure the 60s never happen again, but to move the society back into a position where corporations dominated everything, especially government. What we have been treated to over the past 2 years is what corporations hope government will be like. I'm not saying every wealthy person and indeed every corporation wants this to be true, but you need to understand this was the goal from the beginning. To have the representatives in Congress sniping at one another over BS. And by the way, just a quick note. Somebody had asked me why I don't swear that much on my podcast. It's just who I am. It's just who I am. I don't oppose swearing. And in fact, there's a couple of times where I've definitely slipped up, and because I was, you know, in the mood of passion, I've sworn on here, but I don't typically say the F word. I don't say S. That just ain't who I am. It's just not who I am. Now, there's other times outside of here that, yeah, I'll talk my trash, but it's not who I am. This is serious work to me, and, you know, I come from that school of thinking, I must say, where swear words are reserved for important moments when you want to pull people awake and say, listen, oh, this dude is real serious because he don't really swear like that. It's true. So that's why. Back to the point, though. To have Congress filled with people who have more fealty to an ideology than to actually improving the lives of the people who they supposedly represent. And here, I want you to understand, because of their ideology, they actually represent the wealthy. They don't represent their communities, but their communities don't understand that. They wonder why things keep getting worse as they're voting these people in. It's because they don't represent you. You keep sending people who tell you constantly that they represent the business class, and the business class has an interest in keeping you poor. That's just a fact. But to have that as a reality throws into absolute chaos one branch of this three-branch government. Moreover, it turns the presidency into a strict administrator who must decree things through the bureaucracy to get things done because legislation isn't moving. So now they've ground up the gears of government. At the same time, they're capturing the judiciary and grinding old legislation up through the judiciary, tearing old legislation apart, which needs to then be restructured, but it can't be restructured because what? The legislative process has been ground to a halt. And because the legislative process can't reset that legislation, which used to happen whenever there was a court ruling, because they can't do that, corporations are then able to interpret law however they want, or to the broadest degree as possible because of the rulings within the court. This was the goal of the Powell memo. When people talk about how things used to be, how things were so much greater back then, they're talking about the 1800s. They're talking about the post-Reconstructionist period where corporations ruled, the early 1900s during the Progressive era where corporations still ruled. The government worked for the big corporations. It did not work for the people. That's what they're talking about, and that's what they're creating now. On this point, what they're creating now, because we keep talking about fascism, but we are not talking about fascism, how we should be talking about it. And what I mean by that is, we aren't seeing fascism as an oligarchic corporocracy, because we have an idea of fascism that is rooted solely in a misinterpretation of what happened in Germany and Italy. We are not looking at fascism through the lens of history beyond that. I keep hearing people, progressive liberals mostly, I keep hearing them say that Donald Trump is the biggest threat to democracy. Keith Olbermann is the only person who I've heard speak somewhat openly, and it has been quickly, and he hasn't said it in a while, but he has spoken somewhat openly about why Donald Trump is the biggest threat to democracy. Now, he may think otherwise. He may think, well, I'm speaking thoroughly on, but he's not. And the reason he's not is because he's not explaining why he is the biggest threat. Donald Trump is the biggest threat to democracy because he is the spear, he is the tip to a large apparatus that is pushing him forward into power. And that large apparatus is filled with a lot of wealthy people who really want what he's going to do if he gets into power. Beyond that apparatus, the pressure that has been released, jettisoning Trump towards the presidency, well, that's the people who have bought in to this vague idea of what Trump may do for them. And the only reason they have a vague idea, or excuse me, they have a belief in that vague idea, is because they have no other idea that they can depend on. Now look, I am not like a lot of other people. I'm not like a lot of other people who believe that this is just some great cosmic mistake by people in the Midwest. I'm not. These people are not foolish. They are not being duped. They're not being misled. Many of these same people had issues with Martin Luther King back in the 60s. Had issues with the civil rights movement back in the 60s. We tend to do a lot of obfuscating. Can't say that word, apparently. Covering it up. We tend to cover up the fact that middle America was not necessarily on board with this whole undoing Jim Crow type of thing. We cover it up a lot. We don't talk about it, but they were. They weren't necessarily on board with it. A lot of them weren't. Hence the reason why a lot of your sundown towns are still out there. These people have always had this problem with grappling with true progress and true prosperity. They've always had the problem of that. Now, I personally think it's a lot of cognitive dissonance, which is why they have always had this issue. If I, or my family members, participated in stealing away land from a bunch of people, cultivating that land to the point of almost destroying it. That was the dust storms back in the 30s and 20s and into the early 40s. To the point of killing the buffalo and everything, almost everything, out there that used to give substance to the life that was out there. If I did that, I think I would have to do one of two things. I would have to deal with the emotions from that. Or, and I think this is where a lot of people out there are at, I wouldn't have to deal with the emotions of that. And I would have to create a myth that covers over those emotions. It's just a fact. That myth detaches the reality created from the reality desired. Cognitive dissonance. That cognitive dissonance is showing in their voting habits. They cannot see the reality of those who are literally scamming them every day and taking their wealth and taking their prosperity, destroying their communities. They don't see it. And because they don't see it, they keep making the wrong choices. Now, I know Driftglass calls these people programmable meatbags. I think he's right. But the reason as to why they're programmable meatbags is seldom discussed. I want to give out a shout out to the Dollop. D-O-L-L-O-P. The Dollop. Who has produced some amazing historical episodes on the life of people living on the quote-unquote frontier. And there's one in particular that I am absolutely blanking on, and it is an amazing one, and I'm terribly sorry because I didn't know I was going to bring it up. But what I love about this episode, and maybe I'll try to find it and put a little bit of it at the beginning of this episode, but what I love about the story they tell is how raw it is, and how truthful it is. And what I mean by that is simply, they talk about things that we have forgotten. Like, people who were working for some of these large corporations who didn't have the capacity to build homes because they didn't have the money. Many of them didn't have the skills. Many of them didn't have the wherewithal to get people to build their homes. Many of these people spent months in foxholes. Now, for those of you who don't know, a foxhole is a hole that is dug out into the earth by a fox, in which then the fox uses that hole to live in. There were people who lived in the Midwest who literally would steal the homes of foxes and live in them until they could find better suitable housing. We don't tend to talk about that stuff. We don't talk about people, and this was on, the Dollop did one on, I think it was the cicadas this one was on, But we don't talk about how, because people were so hungry in the Midwest, they would try to eat cicadas. Tasted horrible, but they would try to eat cicadas. No, actually, I believe that was on the one about the squirrels. There were too many squirrels. We don't talk about what people actually did to survive while they were working to make other people tons of money. And I want you to realize that that sort of trauma, with a T, T-R-A-U-M-A, scars the psyche of a person. And since obviously back then, we weren't doing psychology, we weren't doing psychotherapy or anything like that, what do you think happens to a person with that scarred psychology or that scarred mind? They just pass it on to the next one. They pass it on to their children. If their children are lucky, it doesn't have a huge impact on them. But if you're living in obscene poverty, generation after generation, sooner or later, that's going to have a negative impact on you. Another interesting point that comes from my reading of labor history and stories that dealt with labor history, particularly from the late 1800s, when there was the huge influx, and I guess this was also early 1900s too, but there was a huge influx of Europeans during the post-Reconstruction period. And there was another one in the early 1900s. But the one in the post-Reconstruction period was interesting because many of those immigrants came to already established communities with like-minded and like-cultured immigrants in them who had already been here for a generation or two or more. And from my reading, it seems that what these new immigrants found of these old immigrants, especially those who had been there for more than a generation, was there was seemingly a brokenness about them. And this wasn't spelled out deliberately or exclusively or explicitly within the text. But looking at it from a more modern eyesight, it's easily seen. It is easily seen. The people they encountered had little motivation to improve the situation which they found themselves in, even though the new immigrants would sometimes propose ideas that were common in the land that they had just come from. More, when a lot of the labor protests started churning up, they had sometimes an easier job of convincing the immigrants than the American-born former immigrants or people who were the offspring of the immigrants who had moved there. From a modern perspective, these people were spiritually broken. The capitalist system had destroyed them. Now, the New Deal did a lot to rehabilitate the reality of what capitalism was. And I, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot underscore the change in government attentiveness to the society that occurred because of the New Deal. All of the major changes that took place in this country from 1945 through the 90s, the 1990s, all of the major changes that improved the societal fabric were made possible by the New Deal and the Roosevelt administration. You can look at it as the long shadow of Roosevelt. Prior to that, none of those changes were possible. The society that we see now, and trust me, there are major issues. The society that we see now, though, the more modern society with the modern housing and the modern appliances, all of the framework for that came out of the Roosevelt administration. It came out of the Roosevelt administration. The long shadow of Roosevelt is the reason we live the way we do presently. But a shadow only goes so far. The placement of George W. into the White House ostensibly stopped that shadow from reaching any further than the 1990s. There's a book that I found and I already knew this book had to exist because it was clear to me that neoconservatism was built to undo the New Deal, but it was the book Dark Money that finally confirmed what I had been thinking for years. Then I found this book, which I can't seem to locate on my bookshelf, where it literally spells this out. And I found it. A New Deal, the title is A New Deal in Modern American Conservatism, A Defining Rivalry by Gordon Lloyd and David Davenport. Neoconservatism was built to counter and undo the New Deal. Again, the New Deal in Modern American Conservatism, Neoconservatism, A Defining Rivalry by Gordon Lloyd and David Davenport. It was constructed to undo and reverse the New Deal. This confirmed what I had long known to be true. This brings me to the point which I began with. But let me first say this. The cognitive dissidence associated with the hard life capitalism had created for these folks has regressed them away from the good life that they sought when they first came here. It has broken them from that dream, even though they believe that they are still moving towards that dream, and they believe it because we on the left continue our work to build a better government, which is more responsive to their real needs, not their false ones. But the point that I began with, that the Powell memo led us to this moment, is one that I want to get back to. Because the reality is, if the government is dysfunctional, if the government is broken, if it isn't working the way that people think it ought to work. Then the government needs to be restructured. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there has been a long project exercised, and Tom Hartman has talked about this on his program, a long project exercised by some of the wealthiest people in this country to bring together a new constitutional Congress to rewrite the Constitution. If the government, especially legislatively, becomes so bogged down that it cannot move legislation, the argument for the writing of a new constitution becomes more acceptable to many Americans. I will say, among conservatives, especially those that are definitely in the fascist camp, they have already been convinced of this. I heard people talking about the necessity of a new constitution being written in this country more than 10 years ago. I heard people in right-wing media talking about the necessity of a new constitution being written, again, more than 10 years ago. It has slowly caught on online. Unfortunately, they're running out of time. The demographics are not on their side. And they know it. And they know it, which is what is rushing them towards Trump and pushing Trump forward. Because if it doesn't take place in the next 4 to 6 years, it is most likely, forget about most likely, it ain't gonna happen. And they know it. Which is why the government crisis must be deepened. The more people like Marjorie Taylor Greene that could be sent to Congress, the more, particularly the House of Representatives, can be thrown into chaos. The more people like Mike Johnson that could not only be sent to Congress, but be elevated to leadership positions, the more possible it becomes to bring that chaos element to not only the House of Representatives, but to the Senate and to the American presidency. The goal is fragmentation, people. The goal is chaos that leads to fragmentation. Many of you just don't get that. I see a lot of people joking about the exchange that really prompted me to do this special episode. And it was funny. But I don't want you to lose sight of what you are watching. There's a conversation that's happening throughout the rest of the world that you aren't privy to. This media isn't talking about it. They're in denial. They don't want to talk about it. The countries are talking about the United States falling into dysfunction. They're talking about the United States falling out of a position of leadership. Now, that was going to happen anyway. But they're also talking about these two realities in relationship to the United States possibly going fascist. I read an English article from Der Spiegel. It's a German newspaper publication. I read this article I believe it was in early 2017. And I read a number of articles throughout the first 3 or 4 months of 2017. A number of articles that were along the same line that I'm going to describe here. That line was questioning with a matter of certainty if the United States was falling slowly into dysfunction and fascism and what that meant for Germany and the European Union. In that article and another one that I read probably about 2 months later, and more in the second one than the first, there was a statement that was made about what happens if the Democrats take back the presidency in 2020. There was an understanding by the writer, who was a, well, I don't want to say, because I was going to say I think they were a foreign policy person, but I don't want to say that because they may have not been. Anyway, it was determined by this person that it didn't matter if the Democrats took back the presidency in 2020, the damage would likely already be done, and the slow decline towards dysfunction would not be impeded, though it would be slowed. Why was that the case? Because, see, once you've acknowledged that you've lived in a fascist reality, and you've studied why that fascist reality occurred, you come to understand something. Elections either increase or decrease the likelihood of your society going into fascism according to the seriousness of the collective population in the action desired. What do I mean? I mean that if the collective population is serious about bringing the policies of fascism to the offices they elect, nothing is going to stop them from doing it. But if they're serious about stopping fascism from entering those offices, nothing will stop them from doing it. What changes their seriousness? It is their capacity to understand the consequences of electing the people that they are electing. And if you're dealing with a broken people who are racked with cognitive dissidence, they ain't going to understand anything but destruction, because they have been destroyed. Hurt people. I said in an earlier episode something that I want to talk about here because it needs to be spoken about. I said that Jim Crow apartheid in America was fascism. And I wasn't joking. It was fascism. I wasn't joking when I said that. But what I didn't say, and I may end up doing another episode on this, is that the difference between Jim Crow fascism and Nazi fascism or Italian fascism is nobody called it fascism in the United States, even though it was. The United States has had a fascistic element in its historical record, in its body politic, since it was conceived of. Even before it was conceived of. This is a problem. This is a problem that we don't even acknowledge existing. It's a problem because we don't recognize American-style fascism. We never have. We've acknowledged German-style fascism, Italian-style fascism, Spanish-style fascism. But from the standpoint of the United States, we've never acknowledged fascism here and what it looks like. So, if we've never acknowledged it, how can we see it? How can we see it not only in our institutions, but how can we see it as it begins to come to the surface and be implemented by the populace? The population within the United States was in on the fascism being implemented in this country. They were not only in on it, they desired it. They didn't only desire it, they co-conspired in maintaining it. But again, we don't talk about that. Because we are the land of liberty and freedom. Well, liberty meaning what? Freedom meaning what? America was fascist up until Jim Crow started being torn apart. America was deeply fascist up until the New Deal started ripping apart the power base of corporations in this country. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, those are two separate things and in two separate places. Yes. Contrary to popular belief, the United States of America has never been one country, let alone one nation. The United States of America is two separate countries and often two separate nations, the South and the North. The South and the North. Much of the West is still separated, among that distinction. A overt style of fascism for a long time ruled the South, where a more republicanist oligarchic form ruled the North. Accordingly, you know, if we were to take the Romans seriously, we could say according to the Roman system, they were also fascist. But I'll sidestep that because that gets too complex for this conversation. Both were ruled by oligarchies. Both were ruled by oligarchies with significant holdings in corporations, which allowed those corporations to rule to some extent. But the South was really overt with it. Like, the power dynamics for corporations was severe. They were fascist. We don't call them that, but they were. The North was corporatist, but they had a little bit more limitations to the power that corporations could have. But the reality was, prior to the New Deal, America was a fascist country. But we don't recognize it. And this is so important. Oh man, is this important. Because as we watch the government deteriorate into dysfunction, and we watch wealthy people come together to publish Project 2025, where they explicitly tell you, yeah, we're bringing corporatocracy back here. This is where we're headed. We're bringing fascistic corporatocracy to America. Get with the program. As we watch these things, we really do not appreciate that we've been here before. And because we've been here before, we can go here again. In the psyche of many Americans, there is a long-held belief that the authoritarianism that once ruled in Europe could never come here. What makes you think that? What makes you think that? When the United States was just colonies. And here, I'm not even talking about the organized type that we think of, because when we think of the United States as colonies before it was the United States, we think of these big organized structures. I have bad news for y'all. That was a later development. For a long while, almost a century, colonies were only as connected as the idea that they came from the same place in Europe. And so you had all of these townships that were ostensibly independent colonies. What we don't talk about is how those colonies were ruled. They were ruled like dictatorships. Some more egregious than others. Some more authoritarian than others. But they were ruled like dictatorships. They were ruled much like corporations. Hierarchical. Demanding of the people working there. Demanding of the people who were producing there. They were corporate entities. I mean, literally, they were corporate entities. They were created as corporate entities. Literally. People could buy stock in them. They were ruled, though, like kingdoms. The fascistic nature of these places, which is often lost from history because they didn't fit all of the 14 criteria. The 14 criteria is a new creation. It's a new creation. Fascism would have not looked the same in the 1600s as it did with automation in the 1900s. It just wouldn't have. The corporate rulership of these colonies made it fascistic because it was corporatist. The United States came out of this, but let's back up to, it was from these structures that the more broader colonial structure came into existence after a while, when enough land surrounding these colonies was captured, that they could then connect one to another, to another, to another, to another, to another, to the point where a vast section was controlled by the interests controlling those individual colonies, and then they could say this was a complete colonial structure, not just separate township structures. From there, we then get the United States structure. When you have this authoritarian motion in every cell of who you are, it's hard to identify it when it begins to be pushed to recession. And after a while, when people get tired of pushing it to recession, it begins to emerge again. And we are in a position presently where we just don't see the emergence of something that is within the, that is naturally occurring within the body politic of the United States. Hence the reason why, when we see the dysfunction within this Congress, within this House of Representatives, within the legislature, and even the judiciary, we don't recognize it for the danger that it really represents. The last thing I'll say is this. Take some time to review the Powell Memo. Hang it up somewhere. Keep it close to you. Because I'm going to tell you, you got to know the role that it has played in creating the reality which you live in now. You dig? I want to thank everybody for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please reach out to me. I do love hearing from y'all. If you want to find all the latest episodes, you can at radio4ALL.net, radio4ALL.net, or you can go to my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast. You can also find me on Facebook, Class War Battlefield. And if you want to contribute a little bit, a couple of dollars here, there, makes a difference. PayPal, Cash App, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast. Big shout out to Dr. Oba Tshaka, OBATSH. A.K.A. One more time. O.B.A.T.S.H. A.K.A. Very black YouTube show. Very black YouTube show. Dr. Oba Tshaka show. Shout out also to Roland Martin Unfiltered. To In Class With Car, with Karen Hunter. I've been asked to clarify that she is not a doctorate. So to Karen Hunter, to Dr. Greg Carr, obviously, the two of them In Class with Car, y'all. Very black show, but powerful, powerful, powerful. Big shout out to Black Power Media, the whole crew over there. additional shout out to Indisputable with Rashad Ricky. to Unbossed with Nina Turner. Both of them are part of the Young Turk Network. Much love to millennials are killing capitalism. You better believe it. Face down in the dirt. Capitalism is done. And shout out really to all the black media people out there, you know, showing y'all some love, because we got to build one another. You hear me? Shout out also to the best podcast you should be, you better be, listening to, the Professional Left Podcast. Shout out to the Dollop, D-O-L-L-O-P, to the Majority Report. Man, I use so many of their clips, man. Woo. Democracy Now, Best of the Left Podcast, J with an apostrophe. How you doing, brother? Christopher Titus's Armageddon Update. Great name for a podcast for that, man. Again, man, listen to that, brother. I'm should have been much bigger than he actually is. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Christopher Titus. I'm just disappointed that the man should have had a much bigger career. Big shout out to him. Honestly. Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Welcome to independent media, my brother. Democracy Now with an apostrophe. Y'all know Democracy Now, man. Bradcast. Y'all heard. Shout out. Brad Friedman, Desi Doyen. Y'all keep doing what y'all doing over there. Shout out to the Nicole Sandler Show. Great liberal progressive, or progressive liberal, sorry. Great progressive liberal. Okay, she's more of a centrist liberal. But still a good show. Still a great show. Catch her Thursday with Howie Klein. Man, y'all want something that's really going to get you moving? Check that out. Seriously, check that out. Big up to Owen Jones. And to Richard, man, I'm so sorry. I still don't know how to pronounce your name, brother. I still don't know how to pronounce your name. There's this dude named Richard. Last name begins with an M. He's been doing amazing work when it comes to the Palestinians and the Israelis. Dude has been on it. Great work. Sorry, I just can't pronounce his name. Humanist Report. What's up, brother? Stay strong over there. The Leftist Mafia. Yep, it's a podcast, Leftist Mafia. Yo, by the way, if you check out the Leftist Mafia, realize something, right? Be in it for the long haul. These cats, they have no problem dropping 4 hours on you. So be in it for the long haul. I ain't joking, okay? Rational National, what's up? Didn't know he was really in media, but it makes sense. Secular Talk. Kyle Kalinske doing his thing. It's funny, man. I didn't know if I was going to be back with Kyle for a while, but, you know, I am. I am, man. His work has definitely gotten better. I hate to say it, but I really think Crystal Ball has had a great influence on him in how he produces a show. So, you know, good work, man. Keep it up. Keep doing what you're doing. Who am I missing? I'm missing some people. I know I'm. Zateo. Man, Zateo, just keep on flying, man. Just keep on flying. Independent media is where it's at. Independent media is where it's at. The rest of it can go to hell. Good job. Now we just have to make sure that these people are getting paid enough so they can keep putting out this truth. I know I'm missing some more people. Oh, Dollamore, Jesse Dollamore. Yo, man, big up to you, my brother. Keep doing the work you're doing. I'm sorry, you know, I put you a little bit low on the count today, but I still listen. Hal Sparks, how you doing, man? I'm doing great over here. Y'all listen to Hal Sparks. How did I forget these cats? Breakthrough News. Breakthrough News and Activist News Network, I think is what it's called. Or Activism News Television, something, I'm sorry. But great work. And Dave Hoffman, man, he has done really great. I love his YouTube channel. I really love his YouTube channel. So that's going to do it for today. Look, there's more that I missed. I'm sorry I missed them. But if you want a fuller list, go to my Class War Battlefield podcast WordPress blog and click into the media section. Click into the media section and get every single media source. I'm sorry, I'm doing like two things at once and I shouldn't be. Get every single media source that I listed here and more. Because over there, and I don't say this often enough, over there I have not only YouTube channels that you can check out, I have some loose websites, but I also have a number of really good like blog sites and blogs that you should check out. So thank you all for listening. I am your brother, Brian Mary Diesel Guy, and I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Shout out to Jackson Brown. Shout out to the estate of Michael Jackson, estate of Marvin Gaye. Much love to all y'all. Till the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance. Thank you for listening to Class War Battlefield Podcast, episode 2024.07.00, published on May 30th, 2024. The references contained in today's episode include the following. Clip 1, at the 1 minute 53-second mark, originally published on May 21st, 2024, by the Professional Left Podcast YouTube channel. Episode 805, No Fair Remembering Stuff, The Freedmen Unit. Clip 2, at the 11 minute 44-second mark, originally published on May 22nd, 2024, by the Roland Martin Unfiltered YouTube channel. Jasmine Crockett loves Bleach Blonde Bad Built Butch Body songs. Roland Martin. Clip 3, at the 19 minute 18 second mark, originally published on May 16th, 2020, by the Long Now Foundation. Social Collapse Best Practices, Dmitry Orlov. Clip 4, at the 21 minute 57 second mark, originally published on April 23rd, 2018, by the People for DioGuardi Campaign Archive YouTube channel. GOPAC, American Opportunities Workshop with Congressman Newt Gingrich and Paul Weyrich et al., 01-01-1990. Oh, on New Year's. Clip 5. At the 28-minute, 39-second mark, originally published on November 18th, 2011, by the Rubegonia YouTube channel, R-U-B-E-G-O-N-I YouTube channel, not sure how to say that. 1995, new House Speaker Newt Gingrich makes unprecedented requests for TV airtime. Quick note on that point, on this clip, you really need to go and listen to the entirety of it. I only used a portion of it. It was essentially a presidential pitch. There are a couple of items in the further research section, so please go and check those out. You can find a complete listing of these resources with links included by going to my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast. I want to thank you again for listening, and I'll see you on the next one.